When you're president, you might get called a liberal. You might get branded a socialist. They might even say you pal around with terrorists. Every president knows when to use his most devastating political weapon.
Britt Hume, do you have a comment to make about Bo?
Bo's not my type of dog. I like the name, but it doesn't seem to fit that little sort of girly little dog.
Let me simply say, as the host of this show, there will be no Bo bashing on this show. We are in the tank to Bo. We can criticize the Obamas, not Bo.
Sometimes political ammunition has a wet nose and adorable fluffy hair. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. We're not girly. It's Monday, April the 13th. I'm Femi Okay. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away, but Todd Zwillick is here. Morning, Todd.
Hi. Good morning, Femi. Coming up this hour, a look at the violence over the weekend in Iraq. We'll also learn some strategies for keeping mentally healthy during stressful times. And we take a look at the agenda for the week ahead, domestic, foreign, and canine. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
There's been plenty of publicity over yesterday's rescue of Captain Richard Phillips, who had been held hostage by Somali pirates. But Rear Admiral Richard Gurnon says we can't let that block out the danger of piracy.
We should not let the spotlights, the TV cameras, the focus of the world be removed from that problem.
Captain Phillips was being held on an 18-foot lifeboat with his captors when Navy officials saw a pirate pointing a gun at him. They decided to fire and all three pirates were killed. The Justice Department is considering whether to prosecute the one pirate captured. Meanwhile, in Bangkok...
That was the sound of gunfire heard in Bangkok earlier today. Soldiers fired shots at anti-government protesters who threw back gasoline bombs. The protesters had run amok in the capital this weekend, causing the cancellation of an Asian summit. They support the removal of the current prime minister and support the leader who was ousted 4 months ago. Angel Cabrera is the first Argentine to win the Masters Golf Tournament. He pulled off a par at the 18th hole yesterday to beat Kenny Perry and Chad Campbell, who'd been vying for the top spot. It's Cabrera's second major championship.
Gas prices have climbed 10 cents a gallon in the past 3 weeks. That's according to the latest Lundberg survey. The average price for a gallon of regular is now $2.05, and that's still down more than a dollar from this time a year ago. Many Asian markets were closed for a public holiday today. Japan's Nikkei index closed down 0.3%, and meanwhile, indices in South Korea, China, and Taiwan all rose. Wall Street was closed Friday for a holiday. The Dow opens today at 8083. The S&P kicks off at 857. So we're all a little bit stressed out because of the financial crisis. Now, it has some of us punching pillows, but we're looking for ways to cope. How do you help somebody going through these tough times? Lend them some cash, lend them an ear. And if you have some advice, what kind of advice would you deal out? Tell us, 8778-MYTAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We would like your advice, your coping strategies for our tough economic times. mytake@thetakeaway.org, 8778-MYTAKE. We're listening.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Last week, during a surprise visit to Iraq, Barack Obama, the president, confirmed his plans to withdraw all U.S. troops from Iraq by the end of 2011. And he warned that the next 18 months would be what he called a critical period in Iraq's history.
It is time for us to transition to the Iraqis. They need to take responsibility for their country and for their sovereignty.
Now, over the weekend, a roadside bomb killed an American soldier north of Baghdad, and on Friday, five U.S. troops were killed by a suicide bomber in the northern city of Mosul, the largest number of U.S. troops to die in any single incident in many, many months. It's a potent reminder that not all is yet benign in Iraq, despite the timetable for American withdrawal. Well, here to discuss this is David Phillips. He's a former member of the State Department's Future of Iraq project, who's now at the Atlantic Council. And we're also joined by the BBC's Jim Weir in Baghdad. Let's start with David. David, good morning.
Good morning.
Casualty counts overall suggest that things are getting better in Iraq. But can we just check in here for a second? Is everything good in Iraq, or are we and the Iraqis out of the woods?
Far from it. What we were able to do is to buy a little time through the surge. But the surge only worked because we bought off the Arab Sunnis by supporting the Brothers of Iraq, and we got the radical Shia groups to stand down, and because the Kurds were able to moderate their demands. Iraqis fundamentally still don't get along, so when we talk about an Iraq that's able to govern itself and be at peace with itself and with its neighbors, there's still a lot of work to do.
All right. Well, Jim, from the BBC, I want to turn to you because this recent attack in Mosul where five U.S. troops were killed, what do you make of this? Is this elements of the insurgency trying to remind the United States and the world that this withdrawal, if we accomplish this withdrawal, will not be easy? Are they sending a message here?
I don't think you can read too much into one individual action. It is part of a pattern up there in Mosul. The insurgency has not really been brought under control there as it has in the same kind of way as it has been much more, shall we say, stifled in Baghdad and in other areas. So to take that one incident and say, is this a message, I don't think that's the right question. There are indications, for example, that it was a bit of a target of opportunity situation where the bomber happened to spot a U.S. patrol that had pulled up into a Iraqi police base, which was the actual target. So in that sense, you could say the bomber just got lucky. However, the insurgency is going on there, so it is part of, it's a reminder that there are still pockets, especially in the area just to the north of Baghdad, Diyala province, and up in Mosul, where partly for local reasons, the insurgency has just not yet been tamed. And there is some suggestion that U.S. troops may have to stay there after the deadline or the supposed deadline at the end of June, when they should, in theory, according to the agreement with the Iraqi government, be out of all Iraqi cities.
So, David Phillips, from what Jim Muir says, that the withdrawal that we're all expecting may not actually be a complete withdrawal. Do you agree with that, that we might, quote, withdraw and wind up leaving behind thousands of U.S. troops in hot pockets like Mosul, in Kirkuk, and other places?
President Obama has been clear that we would leave behind a residual force of between 30 and 50,000 U.S. troops. So the goal was never to evacuate and leave the country entirely within the 19-month time frame. If we're going to be able to execute that timetable in any way, shape, or form, we're going to have to be clear with the Arab Sunnis and the Awakening Councils exactly what their role is and where they stand. We're going to have to tamp down sectarian violence, and the government of Iraq has to play a key role in absorbing the Awakening Council members and in being true to their word that, in fact, they are going to work towards a multi-ethnic, pluralist democracy where minority rights are preserved.
Jim, is there any indication that what David Phillips is talking about is happening? How do we know that key elements of the insurgency aren't simply laying in wait, laying low, as it were, for us to draw down enough that there are more targets of opportunity, not just U.S. troops, but members of the Iraqi government, members of the public, and going back to the old violence in Iraq?
Well, there is that suspicion, but the question is whether you are kind of, as it were, drying out the swamp. The insurgency is still there, at least in its remnants. But as David was saying, a key thing happened when the Americans turned around these so-called Sahwa or Awakening Council groups, the Sons of Iraq, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call them, but the former Sunni militias, which were with the insurgency, and then turned against it and teamed up with the Americans and the government. That's a key process which has to be sustained, and it is kind of hanging in the balance. But we've been talking to quite a number of Sahwa leaders in the last few days following reports that they were disgruntled. They had been delays in getting their pay because the pay situation has been transferred from the Americans to the Iraqi government. There have been some administrative delays. Now they are getting paid. Some have been arrested as well, but other Sahwa leaders say that these guys should have been arrested. They were the rotten apples in the barrel. So from the soundings we've made, they seem to be relatively on course for being withdrawn, for being drawn into the Iraqi security forces, or being given alternative jobs, or at least kept on the payroll until they do get other jobs. It's not absolutely definitive, but it's looking not too bad at the moment.
All right. Well, I want to look forward a bit, and I have a question that I'd like each of you to respond to. And Jim, I'll start with you. The president has made the point over and over again. He did it in the election. He's done it since becoming president, that Iraq was a distraction for the United States from the real war on terror, which is in Afghanistan, and the job that needs to be done in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Well, now, of course, our attention is shifting to Afghanistan in a big way, and so is the White House's attention. Is there a danger of falling into the same trap in reverse, where we get focused on Afghanistan and Pakistan and take our eye off the ball in Iraq before things are squared away in the way we say they need to be? Is there a danger that we're not going to be able to use another metaphor, I'm sorry, walk and chew gum at the same time?
I think that danger is there, that everybody should be alive to it. To me, it's like a kind of, you've got a fulcrum in the middle, things tilt one way currently towards Afghanistan, so the Americans, the Islamic radicals themselves, Al-Qaeda, they start focusing more on Afghanistan, and both sides start shifting resources in that direction. It's not inconceivable that a year or two down the line, when a lot of effort has been put into so-called defeating the insurgency, or whatever you want to call it there, or prosecuting the war on terror, it could shift back here if conditions on the ground in Iraq are allowed just to drift. So I think people in charge are really aware of that danger. They're aware of the need to institutionalize political processes in Iraq. So it's not personalized politics, it's institutional politics. And a lot of work still needs to be done on that front, reconciling the Kurds, for example, in the north with Baghdad. There's a big contradiction there. There's a lot of legislation still held up in parliament, such as the oil and gas law, nation-building legislation, which is still pending.
David, can we turn our attention to Afghanistan in the way the president says we need to, and still take our responsibilities in Iraq seriously and not let things get out of hand as we try to draw down?
George W. Bush called Iraq the central front in the war on terror. It wasn't so until we made it the central front. It's important to recognize that in both Iraq and Afghanistan, the United States is not going to achieve a so-called victory. At best, we're going to be able to create an end state that's reasonably stable and that can justify the drawdown of U.S. troops. We can do Afghanistan and Iraq at the same time, but we have to stay very cognizant of the fact that the end game in Iraq hasn't been reached, and there's much more work that has to be done there.
There's much more work. Well, Jim Muir from the BBC, the Iraqi Awakening Councils and some trouble there, and you mentioned it before. Are we confident that they're bought in enough to the Iraqi government right now that despite the flow of U.S. cash in duffel bags or however else it arrives, that they will remain loyal to our mission in Iraq in whatever way we need them to?
I think what you want to be confident in is not that they're loyal to the U.S. mission in Iraq, but to the Iraqi mission in Iraq, and that is, I think, what they're looking out for. It depends on a lot of factors. At the moment, as I say, the transfer to the Iraqi government is not going badly. It could be better. The Iraqi government itself has got financial problems because of the collapse of oil prices. That is quite a major factor, but they do seem to be keeping them not on board in general so far, although they have arrested, as I say, some leaders, and that has caused some ripples. It seems to be going on okay. However, the key thing I'd come back to is this sense of a national platform being built in the center, having a solid political base on which to build the nation. And there's legislation pending. There are differences between Sunnis and Shiites. And, of course, the Kurds are also doing their own thing in the north, and there are tensions there too. If those things go wrong, you could see the Sahwa, the Awakening Councils, Sons of Iraq, call them what you will, coming out again as a Sunni militia championing Sunni causes in a fragmented sectarian situation. That's not what people want to say.
Jim, thank you. We talked with the BBC's Jim Muir, reporting from Baghdad, and David Phillips, a former member of the State Department's Future of Iraq project. He's actually off to Washington to talk Iraq policy this very day.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hello there, I'm Femi Oke in with Todd Zwillick this morning. Are you feeling stressed? Is your hair coming out in handfuls? Can't sleep? Sleeping too much? Looks like you have a bad case of recession blues. What is your advice, or what advice have you received lately that's really helped you just get over the slump because of the financial crisis? Tell us, share it with us. We need your help. 8778-MYTAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, Todd, last week we were talking to our listener about a very similar subject. We're talking about recession depression. We had in a New York Times reporter, Pam Bellick, and she had written an article about this. And her story actually also talked about a lady called Victoria Villarba. Now, Victoria is going to counselling, and she joined us last Thursday as well. She works in Miami at an employment agency where she actually helps people to find jobs, but all of their anxiety is actually making Victoria feel anxious as well.
For me, it really has affected my sleeping, and I sit up and, you know, when it does wake me up in the middle of the night, I generally think of the people that I've talked to throughout the day, but it is certainly affected my sleeping habits.
So the interview last week inspired us to check in with an expert for some advice on keeping mentally healthy during some pretty trying times. And we're joined now by Dr. Robin Koerner. She's a clinical psychologist at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital here in New York City. Good morning, Dr. Koerner.
Good morning.
Robin, tell me about how your work is actually being affected now because of the economy. Can you see it almost as an economic indicator?
Definitely. Times are very tough, as we know, out there. And so we sort of have two groups of people coming in for therapy right now. You have the people who have had direct hits from the economy, or their spouses or family members, job losses, mortgage issues, credit problems. And then you have the second group, the group you were talking about a bit last week, of the people who are just sort of waiting for the shoe to drop. And there's a lot of anxiety and depression happening in both of those groups of people right now.
Can you break it down into male and female? Do men feel different ways of different kinds of stress than women feel even?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we see gender differences in how stress is experienced. The general stress response, you might have heard of the fight or flight response,
right,
when we have overwhelming stress. Well, women tend to do what we call tend and befriend. So when things get very stressful, men tend to become more isolated, separate, whereas women are going to look for support. So if you're married to somebody, let's say, who's lost a job, if your husband has lost a job, he might separate out, he might isolate from you, he might not want to communicate, whereas a woman, she wants to talk, she wants to discuss what's going on. So this can cause major relationship stress.
I've heard lots of reports that changes in station in life, whether upward, up the social chain or downward, can be very stressful. We've heard of people who are poor who win the lottery. You think they'd be happy for the rest of their life, and they're not because their station changes. That
right.
can be stressful. And, of course, what we're talking about the other way around, people who are doing well, paying the bills, all of a sudden they can't. Is it anxiety about not having as much money, or are you seeing people who are actually changing their social station, and that it's really affecting them in that way?
That's a great question, and I think it's a little bit of both, and it also ties back to your gender question. Men tend to be very identified with their jobs. Sort of a vice president of a bank. That's how he sees himself. Whereas women aren't so identified with their role in the workforce. It's much more about family and friends, as I was also referring to earlier. The other thing is, in terms of people who are higher up on the social chain, people there tend to feel like their job is who they are as opposed to just a paycheck, and they often don't feel like they have a purpose in their life. So what we're seeing now in counseling situations are people coming in and realizing, what is my purpose in life? Let me take stock. This is actually an opportunity for me to take a look at what I'm doing with my life and what my priorities are.
For people listening, how do they know that they're actually getting some kind of symptoms of stress? How can they recognize this anxiety?
Well, sleep is a big one, as we heard in that interview. Sleep issues, obviously depression, if you're crying a lot, if you're feeling like you can't be with friends and family, changes in weight, breathing issues, chest pain. I mean, anything physical like that is a sign you need to go to a doctor and get it checked out.
And then what do you do about it? You go to the doctor, you get checked out. Is it a mental issue or is it actually a physical one or perhaps even a combination of both?
Well, very often mental, psychiatric and psychological problems can have physical manifestations, but the cause of it is psychological if it's not an underlying medical issue, if you go to a doctor and get checked out. And in that case, there are medications, but also psychotherapy, talking about it. And there are some techniques that you can take away to help manage your anxiety.
We've seen actually on the news and a lot of our news coverage that people are angry.
Mm-hmm.
They're very upset. Is venting actually a really good way of just getting rid of that stress? Just yelling and kicking the wall? Like,
I've heard of places where you can go to actually throw dishes if you want. That's
exactly,
supposed to help,
punching, right? The old punching pillows,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, some of that discharge is actually a good thing, though. We don't recommend, firearms or throwing objects that can hurt somebody. But the idea of keeping it bottled up, that's not healthy, and that actually can cause a lot of those physical symptoms of stress.
Well, is there anything different about the anxiety that comes from changes in the economy, from people potentially not being able to pay the bills? I mean, stress is all over life, mm-hmm. all the time. People get stressed out and people come for therapy for lots of different
right.
reasons. Is there anything about this that's different? It strikes me that this is so widespread, almost everybody has economic concerns right now. Even take the Madoff situation.
Right.
Even some very wealthy people have lost it all, just to use an extreme example. Is there something different about this in terms of the stress that it causes than normal stresses in life?
Well, the fact that there's so many people going through it and we're hearing about it in the news, we're talking about it here. I mean, we're not the only people talking about this, and everybody is listening to it and hearing about it all the time. So just how it's just in our culture now that this is happening makes it different. You just can't get away from it.
Dr. Robin Koerner, a clinical psychologist at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital here in New York City, thank you so much for joining us. And now with your latest news headlines, Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. 28 minutes past the hour, the Thai military says troops are closing in on anti-government demonstrations who forced the cancellation of an Asian summit over the weekend. Troops fired warning shots and threw tear gas at protesters in Bangkok streets today. Dozens have been injured. The country's armed forces chief is vowing to bring peace and order to the capital. The protesters support ousted Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. They want the current Prime Minister to step aside for new elections. Back in the U.S., rainstorms in the southwest have doused wildfires in North Texas and Oklahoma. Thousands of acres are scorched. Hundreds of homes in both states are destroyed. In sports news, Angel Cabrera is the first Argentine to win golf's Masters. He took it in a three-way playoff yesterday. It's only his second win at a major. Cabrera, speaking through an interpreter here, says he learned a lot since he won the 2007 U.S. Open.
I think I'm more prepared. I think the U.S. Open got me by surprise. This win, I'm more prepared. I know more aware of what things happen.
He edged out Chad Campbell and Kenny Perry in that playoff. Finally, President Obama settled on St. John's Episcopal across from the White House for his Easter services yesterday. The White House says that won't necessarily become his permanent church. He hasn't had one since he broke ties with his old church during the Jeremiah Wright controversy. Femi and Todd.
He's just being a church tease, isn't he?
Well, there's lots of choices.
Will he, won't he?
They'll all be glad to have him.
I'll pop in and see you Sunday, maybe next Sunday another church. Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, it's Femi OK and Todd Swillick together this morning, but in the professional sense, although we could start a rumour. So when the world's economy is melting down, that of course makes us a little bit anxious, but not as anxious as Todd is looking right now. But we're looking for ideas to help us deal with economic anxiety. How do you help someone going through tough times?
Good morning, Troy calling from North Dakota. The best coping mechanisms for tough times are spiritual. Reconnect with or strengthen your faith, your relationship with God. If you focus on the big picture, then you're less likely to sweat the worldly details.
8778 My Take, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org, your recipe for coping with tough times.
Now, the Takeaway began coverage of what the new future energy economy might look like with our Power Trip Energy Series in February. Today, we continue that conversation with a guest. He's David Biello. He's from the Scientific American. He's associate editor, and he's been writing about carbon sequestration. Now, President Obama's stimulus package has $3.4 billion set aside for the development of technology that buries carbon underground. Now, the point of this is that if you bury the carbon gas below the Earth, it can't float around the atmosphere and make global warming worse.
Nice explanation. Thank you.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
Where were you last night when I was reading up?
I was studying pumping carbon underground because it's actually very, very interesting. It's not just for geeks, Femi. It's okay. pretty interesting. And the point here is that oil companies, natural gas companies have actually been doing this for years. David Biello has been writing about that. And we need to ask him about how you get the carbon under there and what are the risks once it's buried. David, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
He's in the studio with us. So carbon sequestration, it's not new. And you make the point in your recent articles in Scientific American that companies have been doing this for a long, long time. How do they do it?
Well, basically, natural gas companies, when they pump that fuel out of the ground, that it already has mixed in carbon dioxide. So nature, by its own lights, has been burying carbon dioxide for many millennia. But in order to sell that natural gas as fuel, you have to pump out the CO2. So they split off that CO2, and in many cases, they then reroute it right back underground so that it's not going up into the atmosphere, as you explained, and making global warming worse.
Okay, well, it sounds easier for natural gas because in this country, we burn a lot of coal in our power plants, and the carbon dioxide doesn't come off until the coal's burned. Isn't it a lot more complicated in the case of this country, where we get a lot of our electricity to capture the carbon from the coal burning process and then get that underground? Is that seems like it's a lot harder.
Absolutely. People say that the first C in carbon capture and storage is actually cost. It's the capturing that costs a lot of money. We put out, human beings, 30 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide every year. About 40% of that, 12 billion metric tons, is coming from coal burning. That's not just the U.S., that's the entire globe. But here in the U.S., 50% of our electricity comes from coal burning. Putting devices on our smokestacks to try to capture the CO2 is difficult because the CO2 is obviously a very diffuse gas. But it's important to try to do that because it's really the only shot we have at controlling the emissions from coal-fired power plants. There are no other options.
David, you've been writing about this carbon capture, carbon sequestration, and the comments on the end of your writing, a lot of it gets very angry. People are calling it fake science, and you don't know what you're talking about. What is the opposition?
The opposition is the typical kind of global warming opposition. There are still quite a few people out there who are convinced that global warming is some kind of scientific conspiracy. So when you start talking about solutions for global warming, then that really raises their hackles. This is not just true in the blogosphere. This is true even in the U.S. Senate. We have a senator there, Senator James Inhofe, who is convinced that global warming is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on mankind. Unfortunately, most of the world scientists disagree with him, and the weather record seems to disagree with him as well.
Okay, but it's not just global warming skeptics or people like James Inhofe from Oklahoma who say it's a hoax. That might be sort of the extreme. But there's another side of potential opposition to sequestration, and it's that it's potentially an excuse to keep burning fossil fuels. And part of the point of getting serious about climate change and global warming is to invest in renewable energy and start using solar and wind and cellulosic energy and these things that are potentially renewable. Sequestration is great, but it's just an excuse to keep using fossil fuels.
Absolutely. That is, you've just outlined the kind of split in the environmental movement. So what I would call the pragmatists, although that might be giving them too much credit, are lining up behind carbon capture and sequestration because of the issues that we've outlined. There's just so much coal burning going on. We're not going to stop doing it. It's too cheap, so we have to find a way to fix it. And then there are more of the utopians who feel that we're going to have to go to renewable energy sooner or later. Let's not waste money trying to clean up coal, which has other problems, because carbon capture and storage does nothing about, say, mountaintop removal mining or the toxic ash left over after you burn the coal. It only addresses the carbon dioxide portion. The utopians want solar and wind.
All right. Well, let me ask you really quick about the geology of this, because it's pretty interesting. You pump a bunch of carbon dioxide down into underground pockets, underground reservoirs, sometimes pools miles wide where oil might be, or deposits, natural gas deposits. An earthquake comes along, ruptures this thing, and poisonous CO2 gas is spewed into the atmosphere. CO2 is everywhere, but in high concentrations, it'll suffocate you. It'll suffocate entire cities if there's enough of it, right? This is a danger?
That is a potential danger, but there are a couple things that I need to clarify there. One is the geology. We all think about it. I thought about it before I started reporting this series as going into underground pockets. It's actually going into the pore space between particles of sand. So an ancient ocean got buried underneath rock. The sand becomes sandstone, and in the pores of that sandstone is where you're storing the CO2. So think of it as kind of interspersed with thousands of particles of sand. Now, when an earthquake comes along and kind of ruptures that, the CO2 is not going to kind of rush to the surface in most cases. It's going to slowly leak up, and if it's pressurized still because it's been kind of deep underneath the earth, when it hits the atmosphere, it just vents like a geyser. You've seen these geysers. Old Faithful is not a CO2 geyser, but a crystal geyser in Utah is. And that was actually created by natural gas drillers in our own country. You can go and visit it. It's a great tourist attraction.
My guest, David Biello, is Associate Editor of Environment and Energy at Scientific American. He's been writing about carbon sequestration, which some people say holds the future to our way of addressing, rather, climate change. David, thanks for being with us. Mark Garrison is here with some headlines.
Thanks, Todd. 20 minutes before the hour, we're hearing new details about a wild story from the skies over Florida. After the pilot died in flight, a passenger had to land a twin-engine plane. This was in the Fort Myers area. It was a remarkable team effort to get the plane on the ground safely. The air traffic controller called a friend who knew how to fly it. Then they told the passenger how to land it. The passenger had flown some small planes before, but never a big one like the one he ultimately had to land. President Obama speaks later this morning to highlight tens of billions of dollars in stimulus money for transportation. And speaking of transportation, gas prices are up 10 cents a gallon in the past 3 weeks. That's according to the Lundberg survey that puts the average price of regular at about $2.05. Femi and Todd.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Femi Okay. There is continuing violence and clashes in Thailand this morning as anti-government demonstrations continue in Bangkok. Dozens have been injured, and for an update, we go to Seth Meidens. He's the Southeast Asia correspondent for the New York Times. He's currently in the streets of Bangkok in the thick of all the protests. Seth, what are you seeing right now? Set the scene.
Okay, it's quite late in the evening right now. There have been running battles during the day between the so-called red shirts, red-shirted protesters supporting former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, who was ousted in a coup, and soldiers and police who have been facing off with them. Right now, it's quiet. We're waiting for what we think will be the big clash. The protesters are about a half a mile down a road from me, and I'm standing in an intersection among soldiers and police with riot shields, helmets, bulletproof vests, tear gas canisters, a military vehicle with a machine gun, loudspeakers, fire trucks. And the ground is littered with stones and broken glass from a previous clash when the protesters faced off with the soldiers and threw volleys of rock.
Now, the former Prime Minister has been removed from office some time ago. So what sparked these most latest protests?
I didn't quite hear you, but the former Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawat, was ousted in a coup in 2006. The protesters, broadly speaking, are supporting him. They're facing off against the so-called yellow shirts, who were the ones who were protesting some months ago, the ones who took over the airport in November in Thailand, the other side of the divide, representing the established elite against the backers, mostly from the rural poor, of former Prime Minister Thaksin.
Now, the military chief in Thailand says that every means possible will be used to end the chaos. That sounds very ominous, Seth. What is he talking about?
It's hard to know. It looks like they're preparing to move in on a large camp where these red shirts have been in front of Government House for a number of days, close to the place where the yellow shirts previously were camped out. What we have here is ranks of military and police that could move into this encampment and clash with the protesters who've been living there. In addition, in the dark streets around here, as I tour around, I see many, many men with sticks and machetes in civilian clothes, local people, vigilantes, and I've seen them taunting the red shirt protesters before. And I think that one thing that the government may, one tactic that may be taken is to pit civilians against civilians and have them have it out with sticks and stones in the streets, which is a pretty awful prospect.
Seth Meidens, he's the New York Times Southeast Asia correspondent. He's in the streets of Bangkok covering the most recent protests there. Thank you very much for joining us, Seth.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Now you're listening to The Takeaway with Femi Okeh and Todd Swillick. We are asking this morning, how are you coping with anxiety and stress because of the recession? Is somebody helping you? Are they giving great pieces of advice? It's really easy to join in our conversation. We'd love to hear from you. You might actually help me and Todd out a little bit. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE is our telephone number. And you can also get hold of us via email on mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. It's Todd Zwillick sitting across from Femi Okeh. We're here for John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. And Mark Garrison is here with your headlines this morning.
Thanks, Todd. 12 minutes before the hour, and Somali pirate leaders promised to hit back at the U.S. after Navy snipers killed three pilots to free an American cargo ship captain. The fourth pirate had already surrendered. The American captain is doing well. Authorities are investigating a fire that destroyed dozens of summer homes in eastern New Hampshire. It began yesterday afternoon at a Christian center. The cause is unclear. Many of the homes are believed unoccupied, so no reports of injuries just yet. Meanwhile, rainstorms have helped firefighters to contain several large blazes that have burned for days in parts of Oklahoma and Texas. The rain doused the smoldering remains. The wind-fueled fires destroyed hundreds of homes in both states. Finally, 13,000 hard-boiled eggs are ready for the 30,000-some kids expected for today's White House Easter egg roll just in a little over an hour. Femi and Todd.
Thanks, Mark.
Our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
So it's Monday, Todd, and I think you've been around here long enough to know what happens on Mondays. As always, we have the agenda segment, looking to the week to see what's ahead for domestic and foreign policy. Joining us is our friend Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for the New York Times. He's in the studio with us. Marcus, we have a ton to talk about. Tomorrow there's Goldman Sachs. They unveiled their first quarter results and starting off a big report week for banks. President Obama heads to Mexico on Wednesday. India begins its elections on Thursday. And, oh, there's a little dog that we have to talk about in the White House. But first of all, let's start with the earning reports. The six largest banks by assets are set to report their largest quarterly figures over the next 2 weeks. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Femi, what we're going to see this week is going to be this continuing kind of battle on Wall Street between the bulls and the bears. So, is the economic glass half full or is it half empty? And we've seen this battle play out over the last few weeks. It may come to a head this week where we actually see, are we at actually kind of a trough have we seen a trough in the economic situation, especially in the market, is going to continue to go up? Or will we actually see a kind of a double bounce? A kind of a fall where the actual we see a double dip and the market actually starts to go down.
Well, Wells Fargo last week actually reported some profits. So is that telling us that we might well see some profits coming out for the next week?
Well, that's exactly right. On the bull side of it, on the fact that the market should continue to go up, we'll see actually, and Wells Fargo stuff, as you said, this very positive rally. We're going to see Goldman. We're going to see J.P. Morgan, again, with probably very positive first quarter figures. I think we're going to see that's going to lead to a new kind of battle we've just started now between the administration and banks. They're going to be the kind of return of arrogance. As we see the return of bank profits, we're also going to see a return of arrogance on the part of the banks, who are starting to push back more and more against the administration and things like the stress test that they're putting out on major banks. If a bank actually passes its stress test, these guys are going to say, well, look, we're ready to give our money back to taxpayers and you get out of our business.
The return of bank arrogance and profitability while they're being held afloat with taxpayer money. What does profitability mean when you're getting 30 or 40 or 50 billion from the taxpayers?
Well, that's exactly right, Todd. That's what I think the administration has already been saying to the banks. Just what the administration will continue to say to the banks. What the administration wants to see is not the return of that taxpayer money. Obviously, the banks are thinking, well, we can have whatever executive compensation we want if we give this money back to you and you'll be out of our business. What the administration wants to see is return to lending. They want to see that this economic, if we have reached a trough in the economic downturn, they want to make sure that we continue to go upward. And the only way to do that is through banks lubricating the system of lending again to keep the economy growing.
Marcus, my toughest booking this week was Todd Zwillich to talk about what's happening in Congress this week. Todd.
You only had to reach 2 feet away, didn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Okay. Tell us what's happening this week.
Well, this is a short answer, Femi. Congress is on recess, which is wonderful. It gives me more time to come here and spend time with you.
Excellent.
They're on recess. This is the Easter Passover break. It lasts 2 weeks, but it doesn't mean they're doing nothing. The members might be away. By the way, what they're doing when they're away, they're not enjoying Easter. They're not hanging out with their families.
Oh, shame.
They're raising money. Ah. Money, 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 money. The list of fundraisers is dozens and dozens deep. This is a key time to go home to the district. Even there are a lot of fundraisers going on in the District of Columbia. They're raising lots of money. In the meantime, the budget's not done. The big federal budget, the House and Senate still have to work out their differences. What's going on this week is a lot of senior staff and some senior members are having some of the fights behind closed doors this week so that when they get out in front of the cameras and the radio mics next week, it's hopefully not quite as ugly, because this is Democrats versus Democrats, House versus Senate. The Republicans aren't really involved.
Well, the Congress might be on a break, but President Obama isn't. He's going to Mexico this week. He'll meet with President Calderon on Thursday and Friday, and at the same time that U.S. policy is focused intensely on reducing Mexican drug cartel violence. Have a listen to Janet Napolitano.
We say enough to the cartels. We take them on and we take them out.
So, Marcus, President Obama heading to Mexico, what can we expect from his trip?
Well, it's interesting. I think the best news the administration could have had in terms of foreign policy was actually the freeing of the ship's captain in Somalia. That had really kind of become this kind of cloud over the administration, and in particular after the president's otherwise very successful trip, I think, to Europe, the Republicans and the opposition started to say, well, he apologized a lot for past American policies. He wasn't tough enough. If the Americans had not gotten out the ship's captain, I think you'd be able to say, well, look, here's the most powerful navy in history, and it's being held captive by these thugs in Somalia. The fact that that is now taken care of and wiped away from the slate, it allows the administration to go forward in from a position of strength as the largest, the hyperpower in the world. The question is now, can that leadership be translated into leadership in the Americas region? And that's what's going to be the question and profile in Mexico this week, and then after Mexico in the Summit of the Americas on the weekend.
Now, we thought we had a big election last year, But there is a huge, massive election coming up in India starting on Thursday. It starts on Thursday. I believe it ends in May. Tell us about the Indian election. What do we need to look out for there, just trying to follow the campaign?
Well, this is the world's most raucous democracy. It's the largest democracy in the world and the world's most raucous democracy. India is a plethora. There are very few national parties, actually, the Congress Party in power being one of them. The question will be, will they be able to maintain their power and increase that power? We'll be doing it in the process of India actually trying this week, the trial begins, of the Pakistani suspect the Indians have for the Mumbai bombings. So that's not the greatest situation in which, you know, this kind of very emotional, horrible tragedy that befell India. It's not the greatest thing to be happening in the middle of an election campaign, but India's going to have both those things happening at one time.
How do you even cover an election that big and make it relevant to the audience back at home?
Well, you know, in this time right now of a great global economic downturn and decline, we see how we're more dependent on one another than ever before. And so what happens in India really does make a difference here in the U.S.
It makes a big difference in Pakistan, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's, of course, the administration said over and over again, and it's true, the critical foreign policy challenge they face is Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that is very much directly related to India.
Now, we can't end this agenda segment without looking forward to something very special. And the president kind of gave us a little idea that it would happen a few months ago.
Sasha and Malia, I love you both more than you can imagine. And you have earned the new puppy that's coming with us to the White House.
Todd Swillick, you have a little theory as to why the White House pull out things like the dog and the Victory Garden and all those little stories that we like to talk about.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's too hard to understand. You hang around Washington long enough, you start to see these stories trickle out from the White House. And I have noticed how very good they are, the White House, at having these stories out that we can talk about for weeks and months. The Obama girl's dog, that one's been resolved, thank God. Where will the girls go to school? Where will the family go to church? What will the organic Victory organic vegetable garden look like? These are all feel-good stories. There's nothing wrong with them at all. I'm not criticizing these stories, but I think it's interesting how good the White House is at putting these stories out, and I think it makes the Obamas and the White House accessible to millions of people who probably have very little, if any, interest in politics. These are people who probably wouldn't engage with the White House on many levels. Historically, maybe they don't vote a lot or they're not interested, but people are interested in the dog, they're interested in the girls, they're engaged with the Obamas. I think it's brilliant.
Marcus Mabry is the international business editor of the New York Times. Todd Swillick, you're not going anywhere. You've got to finish the job today.
I'm right here.
Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you.
So we're all a little stressed out because of the financial crisis. It has some of us punching pillows, but we're looking for ways to cope. What helps you cope? Here's someone with several good ideas.
I'm Julie Butel, calling from Detroit, Michigan, and I am laid off, and I am a homeowner, and I'm also a single mother. We have a choice as to who we compare our lives to. If you choose to compare your life to people who are better off than you, then you will be in a constant state of depression and despair. You could also compare yourself with people who are worse off than you. There are about 20 million people on this planet who are probably worse off than you right now. You can also choose to look at your life and see all the ways that you are so rich, whether it's because of the people you have in your life, your health. It's a choice that you make.
Tell us your take at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And if you've been punching a pillow because of the financial crisis, this takeaway is for you.
Some of that discharge is actually a good thing, though. We don't recommend, firearms or throwing objects that can hurt somebody. But the idea of keeping it bottled up, that's not healthy, and that actually can cause a lot of those physical symptoms of stress.
That's Dr. Robert Kerner from St. Luke's Roosevelt. She joined us in New York City.
And I'm Femi Okay.
I'm Todd Swillick, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Vice Admiral William Gortney reads a love letter.
Richard, your family loves you, your family is praying for you, your family is saving a chocolate Easter egg for you, unless your son eats it first. Well, Mrs. Phillips, keep your son away from those Easter eggs, his dad's headed home.
The Phillips family get their happy ending, but the plot continues for the Somali pirates in East Africa. Pirates and why they intrigue us, coming up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, April the 13th. I'm Femi Okeh. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away. And I can't roll him down Capitol Hill because he's here sitting right next to me, Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hey, good morning, Femi. Coming up at this hour, we'll talk about the 200 other hostages still being held by Somali pirates. We'll also take a look at the fight brewing between President Obama and the private student loan industry. And we'll get the lowdown on the IOC's visit to Chicago, which is vying to hold the Olympic Games in 2016. Those stories coming up. But first, these headlines.
Admiral William Gortney says it took only three shots for Navy snipers to kill the Somali pirates holding Captain Richard Phillips. He told NBC News that the Navy was prepared to take action as soon as they saw a gun pointed at Phillips.
Because they were exposed and the on-scene commander took it as hostile intent, he authorized the SEALs to engage, and there were three shots and they were all failed.
Captain Phillips had been held hostage in the 18-foot lifeboat since last Wednesday. Gortney also says the violent ending of the incident could prompt pirates to retaliate.
There's second and third order effects to every action, and this could escalate violence in this part of the world. No question about it.
More than 200 other people are being held hostage by pirates right now, according to the watchdog group, the International Maritime Bureau. Todd.
Femi, thousands of Thai protesters surround the area near the Prime Minister's office in Bangkok. They say the parliamentary vote that brought the leader to power 4 months ago is unconstitutional, and they want to restore their democracy in their country. Protest leader Jakaprab Penka.
The point is, whoever will be Prime Minister or government is much secondary to the point that we have the basis of democracy back in the country. It was taken from us, and it's lost.
The protesters caused plenty of trouble over the weekend, forcing the Thai government to cancel a major summit of Asian leaders. Angel Cabrera won the first major golf tournament of the year. It's the Masters. It's the first time an Argentine has won it. He beat out Kenny Perry and Chad Campbell, who'd been in a dead heat for the top spot. It's Cabrera's second major championship win.
Gas prices have climbed 10 cents a gallon in the past 3 weeks. That's according to the latest Lundberg survey. The average price for a gallon of regular is now $2.05, but that's still down more than a dollar from this time last year. And Wall Street was closed on Friday for a holiday. The Dow opens this morning at 80.83. The S&P kicks off at 8.57. So we're all a little bit stressed right now because of the financial crisis, and it has some of us punching pillows, but we're looking for ways to cope. How do you help somebody going through tough times? Do you give them some money? Do you give them some advice? If you've suffered from some recession blues, tell us your advice. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
It's Femi Okeh and Todd Zwillick this morning in for John and Adora. People around the world breathed a sigh of relief yesterday when the captain of the cargo ship Maersk Alabama was rescued unharmed from Somali pirates who had held him hostage for 5 days. Although this one prominent case is over, the crews of about 12 other ships, more than 200 people altogether, are still being held by Somali pirates. That's according to the watchdog group, the International Maritime Bureau. Author and broadcaster Nick Ranking made a three-part documentary on pirates for the BBC last year. He joins us now from London with a look at the menace of piracy today and the hold it continues to have on our imaginations. Morning, Nick. Tell us about your experience with Somali pirates.
Well, I went to Mombasa to make this radio programme and I interviewed several captains who'd been captured by Somali pirates and talked to people who knew something about how this whole system worked. And what you've got to understand is that Somalia hasn't had a government for nearly 20 years. Here's a country that has fallen apart in violence and During that time, because there's been no government, there's been no law, as it were, on the sea. And so people have gone in there fishing illegally and dumping toxic waste. So the piracy kind of began by some Somalis saying, we ought to tax these people coming into our waters. And, of course, the place was full of civil war, awash with weapons and arms. And having no government, being a failed state, means what? I mean, these young men, one of them told my friend in Mombasa, he says, look, I've never been to school. I can't read or write. I have no prospects at all. All I have is my courage and this, waving his Kalashnikov. And so what happened was it started up in Puntland, which is the kind of tip of the Horn of Africa. There was a long tradition there of kind of wrecking ships and taxing ships. And basically what they do, it's not stealing the cargo. It's taking people hostage and then getting a ransom. And it's really about getting money. And if people pay, the hostages are given back. Now, in most cases, in pretty well every case I can think of, they haven't harmed the hostages at all. And negotiations take place. This is all happens in the world of the mobile phone. Negotiations take place, money is paid, and then people are freed. But the amount of money that's being earned is huge. If there's a destroyed, failed state with no income, no industry, this becomes a magnet for young men desperate to earn money, like the drug trade or anything like this. It takes men of courage who are desperate for money.
Nick, tell us about the modern technology that the pirates in Somalia are actually using nowadays.
Well, I mean, the point about Somali culture is that essentially it's a warrior culture anyway. If you look at Somali history, these are some of the bravest and most terrifying people on earth. I was reading a book by a man who was in the Second World War in Somalia, and they didn't have a great deal of weapons then, but seven of his comrades in the British administration shot themselves out of horror at what was going on. What's happened is they have modern weapons like rocket-propelled grenades, AK-47s, and the fighting on shore. There's all kinds of weaponry there. But it's the mobile phone and the modern internet. The Somalis, basically an oral culture, have taken to the internet like nobody's business. And the mobile phone is incredible because when they take a ship, and these guys go out in small boats, okay, speed boats, more modern technology, they throw grapnels up and they clamber up, just like guys in the 18th century did, onto the ship. They take the ship and then they get the captain to radio his owners and saying, look, we've taken it. Then, and they give him a mobile phone number and they say, now you negotiate. And negotiations take place. And these are kind of secret, and then the money is delivered by kind of ex-special forces people who work with maritime insurance. And the money's delivered sometimes by helicopter, parachuted in. And then the people having been looked after are freed. But the rich people get freed. It's the poor guys who don't, because maybe they can't muster the ransom. And so poor African sailors are stuck in Bosaso or Hobyo or someplace for months. I met somebody who'd been 3 months rolling in a rust bucket off the coast of Somalia. So it was pretty terrifying. But, you know, with GPS and these phones, people know where they are, and they can get freed.
Well, Nick, we're hearing this morning from some of the remaining pirates that they're vowing revenge for their, I guess, their fallen comrades. They would call them the three that were picked off by Navy snipers earlier today in the rescue of the American captain. From what you know about these Somali pirates and their bonds with one another, is that a credible threat? Are they loyal enough to one another that they would pick a fight with the U.S. Navy or with anyone else, or are they going to want to start to kill hostages, which is really their currency at this point if it's all about money?
I don't believe they're going to start killing hostages. I mean, they'll stand up for a fight. I mean, the point is, it's like warrior's honor, isn't it? The U.S. Marines say, you know, no man left behind. I mean, it's interesting to look at your own military. The U.S. Marines why do they go to the shores of Tripoli? What were they doing in 1803? They were going to rescue an American ship that had been captured by Barbary pirates. So this problem is going on for 200 years. And like any warrior, you know, if someone challenges you, kills your mates, you're going to stand up and shout about it. I don't necessarily think they're going to start killing hostages, because that's killing the golden goose. I mean,
right,
there's no point in doing that.
It's
but
the currency.
They will stand up and fight, though.
Nick, there's always when we mention the word pirates, there's certain images that come to mind, even as we're following events off the coast of Mombasa, the coast of Somalia. Let me just take a little pause here and bring in Mr. Orson Welles.
Nothing charms, nothing ingratiates, nothing wins like a one-legged, double-barreled buccaneer with earrings, a handkerchief on his head, and a knife in his teeth. What could be more appropriate on the starboard rail of your four-masted brigantine? If you haven't a four-masted brigantine, you have Treasure Island. It's in your library because it's a great English classic, and this evening, because it's a great story, it's on your radio.
So in your study of pirates, you not only looked at contemporary pirates, you looked at historical ones too, and then also where fiction comes into play. Tell us about the influence that fiction has on us in terms of our view and imagination and the way we think about pirates.
I love that extract you've played. It's Orson Welles' Mercury Theatre of the Air's adaptation in 1938 of Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. What you have to understand about piracy is that the Romantics took over this as soon as it began to die out. When the Barbary pirates or corsairs were destroyed, within years, Lord Byron wrote his poem The Corsair, romanticising them. This sold 10,000 copies in a day. Stevenson's book Treasure Island, written in 1883, begins, I take up my pen in the year 17, whatever.
Oh, yes, I remember that line.
Because it's 100 years ago.
It's
100 years ago, it's dead, it's past. And that book, Treasure Island, is a marvellous thing because what is it about? It's about money. There's two groups of people. It's called Treasure Island, they're after money. There's two groups. The gentleman born, the captain, the squire, the doctor, they want to confirm their status by getting this money. And then there are the gentlemen of fortune, these ragged, scarred men on the outside who want to get some status. I mean, Silver wants to be an MP. He says, I should be rolling in a coach instead of sponging for a drain of rum. They are desperate for the money. And this is what it's about.
Nick, I want you to do a little bit of myth-busting for us because we're coming close to our wrapping up time here. So you, in your extensive research of pirates, there are a couple of myths that you busted. Did pirates really maroon people on desert islands, yes or no?
Yes, I think they did. That's certainly true. Some of them had wooden legs because they were in combat. They were scarred. Lots of them had parrots, things like that. They didn't really bury treasure. They went and spent it. That's the whole point. On girls and grog and gambling. That's what pirates did. Their lives were nasty, brutish and short. They were violent. They've become symbols of freedom now, and now we have all these people who steal things on the internet and call it piracy. It's still robbery, but we've romanticized it by saying they're against the system. And it's true that the pirates were egalitarian and they did have their own rules outside the system, but they were also seen as the enemies of all mankind, which is why international law pursues them and will pursue these pirates now.
Two quick things I have to ask you. First one is, what part did the US Navy have in destroying the pirate trade?
Well, I think that if you go back to look at that early history in the Mediterranean, there was a kidnapping of a ship, and the US Navy was first formed. I think it was, I can't remember who the president was. Was it Jackson? Was it Jefferson? I can't remember. At the beginning of the 19th century. And the US forces went in there to help destroy the Barbary corsairs, who basically worked out of Algiers and had done for centuries, raging across the Mediterranean, kidnapping people, putting them in slavery. Cervantes, the author of Don Quixote, was captured by pirates. Pirates in the Mediterranean went back to Greek and Roman times.
Nick, we've almost run out of time, but I've heard your documentary and I know you do a brilliant pirate voice. So will you just sign off in pirate for me, please?
Goodbye!
That was Nick Rankin. He's an author and a broadcaster and a nutter. You're listening to The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. There is a showdown over student loans in Congress, and President Obama is about to go head-to-head with the powerful private loan industry. The president wants to eliminate the middleman, essentially. Big banks act as lenders for subsidized student loans right now. But the Congressional Budget Office says that replacing those loans with direct government lending could save billions, tens of billions, actually. But lenders like Sallie Mae and big commercial banks don't appear to be backing down. You wouldn't back down either if you were about to get cut out of an estimated $94 billion of business over the next decade. For more on the fight over student loans and a look at the budget in general, we're here with New York Times reporter David Herzenhorn, who reports on this in today's paper, and he's my colleague from the halls of the Senate. David, good morning.
Good morning.
What exactly is the president proposing on student loans, and how are the banks reacting?
Well, the banks aren't happy, and keep in mind that that $94 billion, according to the CBO, is the savings, right? This is an $80 billion plus industry a year. It's huge business. And if you remember when the budget fight got underway, the Congressional Budget Office score, their projections, were actually mostly tough for the Obama White House. It forced lawmakers in Congress to turn around and make a lot of cuts to what the president had been proposing, because it turned out the projections by the CBO were a lot more pessimistic than what the White House was saying. On this one issue, though, it went the other way. The White House originally said we can save $24 billion over 5 years, $47 billion over 10 years. CBO says, no, you can actually save more than that by cutting these banks out. They certainly want to press ahead and try and do that at a time of huge deficits. So what you end up with is a situation where the banks, who have been fighting this battle for years, I mean, this was first proposed by President Clinton. And in fact, George Bush, the first George Bush, was the one who created a direct lending program to say the government can do this, you know, more cost effectively. The idea here is to get students to pay for college, not to be paying fees and subsidies to banks. And now with the government providing the capital, taxpayers essentially pay these banks to lend out taxpayer money, only to then sell the loans back to the Treasury after the fact.
All right. Well, I want to ask you about the fight in Congress, because the commercial banking industry is on its knees, and they're not exactly the most popular industry in the country right now. Do they have any clout to fight the president over this? Where's their leverage on this?
You know, they do. If you look back in the congressional record, you know, as the budget fight was unfolding, you know, Alan Boyd, congressman from Florida, saying, yep, you know, these jobs are important. Think about this. The Budget Committee in the House included language that said, you know, there should be some role for private industry here.
Let me guess, because they have commercial banks in their districts, right? They want to protect these jobs.
They have
parochial
loan centers. Sure, they have loan centers. Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska said this is one of the reasons he broke with the Democrats and voted against the president's budget. There's a huge student loan operation in his state of Nebraska. And so it becomes a jobs issue. It becomes an issue on many different fronts. And believe it or not, there are folks who will defend the role of these private banks, in part because they do provide competition. I mean, there's no way to argue against it, even if it's government-sponsored competition. Once these guys are out of the mix, you know, if something goes wrong with the government-run program, you know, there isn't anybody else.
All right. So we're talking about the budget, and there's work going on in the budget. This is congressional recess. There's no votes this week. But staff is talking. Can you bring us up to date on where the budget is at and what this is going to look like when Congress comes back?
Well, you know, the biggest question, of course, is this procedure known as reconciliation.
Oh, yeah.
That's the question. That the House included language that would allow the Democrats to use the budget as a vehicle for healthcare overhaul, for for education changes, and this is obviously a big fight. And it seems that the Senate Democrats are coming around to the realization that they don't have much choice. Although they've been warned again and again by Republicans not to try this, they're seeing this as their last best chance if they can't cut deals on a number of fronts.
Well, this has sort of been compared to kind of a nuclear option, you know, using the budget for these big policy shifts. I mean, healthcare is 17% of the economy. I've heard the Democrats saying, no, this is just a backup plan. We want to bring Republicans to the table. We want bipartisanship. This is our plan B. If they treat this like they treated the stimulus and they decide not to cooperate, we can hold this threat of ramming this through over their heads. Do we believe them that it's strictly a plan B?
Did we believe folks who said there was a new era of bipartisanship headed for Washington after this last election? It's democracy and it's messy. Certainly, it is a plan B. But whether there's much attention paid to plan A is the question.
I don't want to be too simplistic about this, real quickly, David. But is bipartisanship, I don't know if it was ever born, but is it officially dead in Congress if Democrats use this tactic? Republicans are already calling it their new nuclear option. Is it dead if they do this?
I think they do it if they can turn around and say bipartisanship is dead because the Republicans were never willing to give Obama's proposals a chance, right? I mean, you brought up the stimulus package, which obviously was approved with zero Republican votes, not one. If the initial signs we're getting that the economy is turning around are, if there's anything to that, if things start to improve and Democrats can turn around and say, the Republicans have been trying to block us at every turn. They never gave this president a chance. Congressman Boehner, the Republican leader in the House, said he was going to vote against a lot of this stuff, even before the debate got underway. Then they may have grounds to push forward on reconciliation. It will be messy. It will be a brutal fight. There's no question about it.
Thank you, David, for joining us. That was David Herzenhorn, a reporter for our partners, the New York Times, and my colleague at the Senate, talking about education fights and the upcoming budget. Mark Garrison is here talking about the upcoming headlines.
Thank you, Todd. 28 minutes after the hour, President Obama speaks a little later this morning to highlight tens of billions of dollars in stimulus money for transportation. The administration says some 2,000 projects have gotten money in the last 6 weeks. American drivers are paying 10 cents more per gallon of gas on average. The latest Bloomberg survey reports the jump in the last 3 weeks. The average price for a gallon of regular is now $2.05. That is a jump, of course, but it's often still well below what drivers were paying a year ago by more than a dollar. Five people are dead and another seven seriously injured after a boat struck a docked tugboat near St. Augustine, Florida yesterday. No one was on the tug. The pier was under construction, actually, so rescuers had to lay down planks before they could get to the crash victims. In about half an hour, tens of thousands of spoon-wielding kids will storm the White House for the annual Easter egg roll. It's a tradition that goes back to the late 19th century. For the first time, the White House gave out tickets online. The Obama administration says this lets a wider variety of families take part. In weekend box office, Hannah Montana the movie dominated the Easter weekend. Teenage cash machine Miley Cyrus beat everything else out there, hauling in $34 million. Fast and Furious and Monsters vs. Aliens round out the top three. Todd and Femi.
I have seen all three of those, by the way. I just want to say.
And your review?
Excellent, excellent, and really excellent.
Okay.
I love the egg roll online story. It's very egalitarian. I'm sorry. We had time.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Femi Okeh and Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. When the world's economy is melting down, that, of course, makes us a little bit more anxious. So we're looking for your ideas to help us deal with our economic anxiety. How do you help somebody going through tough times? We'd love your advice. Our email number, or our email address, is mytake@thetakeaway.org. And our telephone number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. Todd.
Femi, the International Olympic Committee visited Chicago recently and created quite a stir because of the positive responses from the committee members, making Chicago a viable contender for the 2016 Olympics. If the Olympics were to be held in Chicago, the proposed site would be in the South Side, in a place called Bronzeville, to be exact. This is a low-income community that has fought against widespread gentrification and is worried that having the Olympics there in their neighborhood may encourage exactly that. So joining us this morning is Natalie Moore. She's a reporter with WBEZ Chicago for the South Side Bureau. She knows the community well because she actually grew up in Bronzeville and still lives there today. Natalie, good morning.
Good morning.
Is this a case where the city elders are excited about having Chicago be an Olympic city, but the folks in your neighborhood just don't want it?
It's not quite as simple as that. A lot of people in some of the surrounding South Side neighborhoods where a couple of the proposed venues would be are saying the Olympics would be fine here, but let's make sure that there are jobs, housing, and other type of contracting opportunities.
Okay, so IOC officials met with some community groups and some people living in Bronzeville. I want you to listen to this. This is a resident that you spoke with from Bronzeville talking about the interactions with the community with the IOC.
The IOC was kept in a bubble this week. If anything, they actually got to hear a little bit of what's really going on in the city.
All right. What's he talking about? What did they hear about what's really going on in the city?
Well, he's actually from a different camp. He doesn't live in Bronzeville, and he's part of a coalition called No Games Chicago. So that group is not interested in any type of agreements with the city and the private group in Chicago that's doing the bid. They think that No Games believes that any spending on the Olympics would be too much and that the city has a lot of other problems. And that's what they talked to the IOC about, corruption in Illinois, budget problems with the school and with public transit.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you about that because, fair or unfair, some people would say fairly, Chicago is almost synonymous with political corruption in this country. Would the public have faith, if the Games were to come to that city, that Chicago would be able to handle the multi-dozens of billions of dollars that are involved in an Olympic Games and do it in a transparent way?
Mayor Richard Daley has said repeatedly that no taxpayer dollars would be used to fund the Olympics. And I must say there are a lot of people who are skeptical about that. They're saying that we're going to raise this money from corporate and from businesses. But, you know, at the end of the day, what does that really mean? So absolutely, people are worried about that.
All right. Well, I want to bring it back to Bronzeville on the South Side real quickly, if we might. What are residents in that community saying about the whole process? Have they gotten a reaction from the IOC? And what exactly do residents in Bronzeville, where the velodrome might be or the stadium might be, what do they want out of this whole deal if the Games should come there?
Well, the Olympic Village, where the athletes would stay, that would be in Bronzeville. And then in Washington Park, just south of that, is where the proposed stadium would be. And even though the city is saying, oh, there'll be no displacement because they don't have to tear down houses to build, the surrounding neighborhoods are already going through gentrification. It's a middle class, moderate, low income. All of those elements are currently in those neighborhoods. And so the Chicago 2016 Olympic Committee expanded its community outreach committee to put some grassroots groups on there. And what they came up with was a so-called memorandum of understanding. And some of the key elements in that say 40% of the contracts, Olympic contracts, must go to women and minorities, and 30% of the housing in the Olympic Village after the Games are gone must be earmarked as affordable housing. And this has been ongoing for months. A lot of these grassroots groups really pressured Chicago 2016 into being heard. And a couple of people did talk to the IOC. They didn't really give a reaction. They said that the IOC members just listened and took some notes. And then when there was the final press conference, well, the only press conference that the media got a chance to talk with the IOC, I don't know if dismissive is the right word, but they said, oh, no one will always be happy. Sure, we're listening to concerns, but we trust that the city will do what's right.
All right. Well, what do we know then from the experience of other Olympic cities? I used to live in Montreal, which was an Olympic city in 1976. What do we know from the experience of other cities about whether concerns like those in Bronzeville would be met, or whether the Olympics would just come sort of like a carnival, blow out of town, and then, you know, have tumbleweeds blowing across the Olympic Village?
Right. I've been talking to some people up in Vancouver, and that's the host city for the Winter 2010 Games. And so far, there have been reports that they're spending more than what they said. And there was an agreement that was between the Olympic Committee and the community that talked about what they call social housing, and which basically is affordable housing or housing for low income. And some of those promises haven't been made. Now, the difference, one could argue, between Vancouver and Chicago is that Chicago is on a path for what is called a binding agreement, and it's supposed to pass in city council later this month.
Okay, well, I'm concerned, Natalie, that Chicago isn't getting enough press these days, so I hope that they get a little bit more. I don't think Chicago's been enough in the news. Natalie Moore is the WBEZ Chicago reporter for the Southside Bureau and reported to us from her community in Bronzeville. Natalie, thanks for joining us. Mark Garrison is right here with headlines.
Thank you, Ty. Coming up on 21 minutes before the hour, protests in Thailand are growing and intensifying as the Thai military battles demonstrators. A few minutes ago, we spoke to Seth Mydens. He's on the streets of Bangkok covering the story for our partners at the New York Times. He says the military is trying to close in.
It looks like they're preparing to move in on a large camp where these red shirts have been in front of Government House for a number of days. Close to the place where the yellow shirts previously were camped out.
Note on the colors, the red shirts that Seth talks about are protesters supporting the ousted prime minister. They want new elections. The yellow shirts support the current leader and current government. Somali pirates promised to retaliate against the U.S. after Navy snipers killed three pirates to free the American cargo ship captain. SEAL marksman got the order to fire after one of the pirates raised his rifle in the direction of the hostage. The captors were dead in an instant after three shots. The fourth pirate had already surrendered. He's now in custody and faces U.S. justice. The weather is helping firefighters shut down raging wildfires in Texas and Oklahoma. They got help from rainstorms yesterday. Firefighters did. The rain doused flames that had scorched thousands of acres. Hundreds of homes in both states were destroyed. A new Associated Press poll says Americans are being more frugal with their tax returns than in recent years. The survey shows more than half of respondents getting money back from the government say they plan to pay down existing debts instead of shopping. That's a big jump in terms of saving versus shopping over last year. The filing deadline for taxes, of course, is Wednesday the 15th. The IRS says it's already sent out some $200 billion in tax refunds so far.
Femi, have you filed, Mark?
I'm done. Yeah, I did that a while back.
Goodness. Todd?
Stamps are on. They'll be mailed when I get back to Washington.
Wednesday is the deadline.
That's when they'll be mailed.
Right. Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, it's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Femi Okay. The Masters Tournament in Augusta, Georgia came to an extraordinary close yesterday with a sudden-death victory by Ángel Cabrera. He's the first Argentine in history to win the tournament. Joining me now to take a look at the dramatic finish is the sports blogger Ibrahim Abdelmartin. Ibrahim, good morning. Let us just recap your prediction for the Masters in Augusta on Friday. Now, you had an old guy winning it, but not the old guy who gave it a great shot.
Greg Norman is the fan favorite, so we're looking to see if Greg Norman, the old guy, can make some history and make some drama out of it.
Oh, dear. Whoops.
He didn't want to make a prediction. You made him, as I
did. I made him. It was. I actually turned on the television just as that, as an Ángel actually won. It was perfect timing for me. Take us through the exciting end of the tournament.
Well, even if you don't like golf, even if you didn't understand golf, yesterday was definitely a day to really get involved in it. It was competition all the way through. The very, very end, you had a three-way tie. You had Perry, Campbell, who had been the leader most of the time, and you had Cabrera. People weren't even paying attention to them. But I think, honestly, Cabrera's shot where he hit it into the woods and then he shot it out of the woods and bounced off a tree and then back onto the fairway, that was the shot that won the tournament.
But Perry was almost convinced that he could do it. Have a listen to this.
I've got something that I can achieve that will, you know, it'll move me up another notch on the totem pole and on the PGA Tour. I mean, I go from just a good player to maybe people start thinking I'm a better player than just a good player.
So a lot of guys thought they had a shot at the win. When did the field start to really thin out?
I think Saturday is usually the day when the field changes and shifts. People get cut a lot. Perry is interesting about him. He had a two-stroke lead with two bogeys going into the 17th and 18th. Some say he lost it for himself, and he would say the same thing.
And we were talking about Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson on Friday, but they finished way back, 8th and 9th. What happened to them?
Well, they made it exciting. I think everyone has been waiting for years to get Tiger and Phil on a Sunday at the Masters in a one-on-one. Sadly, this one-on-one wasn't for the championship. It was just for the excitement.
Yeah, I turned it on, and there was no Tiger Woods on the leaderboard. I kind of went, flick. Sorry.
I stayed with it till the end. We're not hearing much from Angel Cabrera because he actually speaks Spanish rather than English, but he does have an interpreter, and his interpreter summed up how he was feeling yesterday.
He says he got goosebumps. He was shaking. He can't even explain what was going through his body.
I'm getting goosebumps just listening to the goosebumps.
I think it's hilarious that they said he was shaky and scared because he was ice cold. He made that. He made those shots, and he was stoic. He runs up to the putt. He just shoots. A lot of guys sit and take their time. They study it. They study the wind.
Read the green.
Exactly. They read the green. He just went up and made it happen. So I don't know. He looked like he was ice cold.
And what was really interesting about Angel is that he was actually ranked really quite low. Mm-hmm. Like, what is he, 69 in the world?
Mm-hmm. I think that's the beauty of the Masters. That's the beauty of Augusta, that at any given moment, any given point, somebody can come from behind, somebody can come and have a beautiful day and make it happen.
I'm going to leave the last word with Angel's interpreter just explaining how happy he is that he got that win. Ibrahim Abdul-Martin, sports blogger for us here at The Takeaway. Thank you for eating humble pie.
Yes, I think I had won a major before, and it was something. When I won the U.S. Open, I wasn't ready for a lot of things. I wasn't playing well, but now I was comfortable and I was happy that I got this win.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm sitting across from Femi Okeh. We're both here for John and Adora, who are out. Mark Garrison is right here. He's got your headlines.
Thank you, Todd. Now that the American cargo captain is safe and three pirates are dead, new questions this morning is how do they prosecute the surviving pirate? Like a lot of them, he's a young teen. The U.S. does have jurisdiction over things that happen in an American ship or against U.S. citizens abroad. Also, thousands of kids headed to the White House for the Easter egg roll. That starts in just a few minutes. And after the egg roll, President Obama will speak later this morning to highlight tens of billions in stimulus money going towards transportation.
Thank you very much, Mark. Who runs your school system? In more than a dozen cities across the country, the school system is headed not by a superintendent or a school board, but by the mayor. And it's a trend that is set to grow. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan recently advocated in favour of mayor control of big city schools, and it has also been considered in cities as diverse as Los Angeles, Dallas, and Newark. So here to tell us more about this growing trend is Professor Joseph Vittoretti. He's the author of When Mayors Take Charge and a professor at Hunter College here in New York. So, Professor, could you call this program When Mayors Go Wild, or are you in favor of this idea?
I'm generally in favor of it with some caveats. I think the experience has shown that where mayoral control has been implemented, it's created a new capacity for institutional capacity for more change so that reforms are possible. It doesn't always assure that the changes are going to be for the better, but it loosens up systems that for many years have been unable to adjust to changing circumstances.
When did we start putting mayors in control of our schools?
Well, the most recent wave began in 1992, when Boston was the first city to adopt the current forms of mayoral control. And it was followed very shortly after that by Chicago. New York has it now. Cleveland has had it. Washington adopted it in 2007.
Are we looking at school systems that are really failing? So you're scraping the barrel on you. Actually need the mayor to come in because nobody has any other ideas.
Well, it's the result of a long period of frustration with urban schools and the success of the students who attend those schools. And it really came about because of a growing demand for leadership and accountability so that one person could be held responsible for what happened in those schools. And that's what we've seen happen.
You mentioned a few locations about where mayors have started to become in control. Where has it actually worked?
It's worked to a great extent. In Boston, for example, we've seen the Boston schools have accelerated in their test scores and performance. Boston, compared to other cities in the state of Massachusetts, it's doing better. But it's certainly not it's not a panacea. It's not an immediate fix. If you compare cities that have mayoral control with cities that do not on the national test scores, they're not really doing any better at this point. That's somewhat a result of the fact that mayors go in to take over school systems that are in the worst shape. So there's been some progress, but in order for it to work, you have to have opportunities for parents to participate in education. You have to have checks on the power of the mayor. It's not a silver bullet. There are no silver bullets in education.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. You mentioned having parents involved, and the whole idea behind local control of schools in this country is that when it comes down to it, the parents either on the school board or on the PTA have a big say in the curriculum and a big say in how their local public schools are run. So in a lot of cases, doesn't mayoral control undermine that notion and sort of make it more of a hierarchical situation the parents are locked out of?
There has been a tension between mayoral control and parent participation in many cities. Wherever it's been adopted, it's gotten very strong support of the business community that likes to see a strong executive take charge who can be held accountable. But it's also created a great deal of anxiety in poor and minority communities who feel that decision-making is being taken out of their community institutions and beyond their political reach. So there needs to be a balance. And so school governance is not a science. It's something that has to be crafted very carefully, and it has to balance the need for executive leadership with the need for community participation, because school systems are public institutions and the democratic process is very important in them.
Professor Vittoriti, you say that where school districts have a mayor in charge, the kids don't necessarily do any better. So what does change when the mayor takes over?
What changes is the ability of leaders to come in and develop new programs and innovations. It doesn't assure you that the changes are going to be for the better, but it is significant that for the first time we're seeing school systems like New York and Boston and Cleveland and Washington adopt innovations that would not have been possible before.
Well, it tends to assure a fight with your local teachers' union, doesn't it?
Very often it does, yes.
That's certainly the case in Washington.
Yeah, and to a certain extent in New York, too.
Tell me about the kind of innovations that a mayor can actually bring in that perhaps a school district or superintendent, a school board couldn't do.
Well, what we've seen school superintendents in New York and Chicago and Washington do is we've seen more of a focus on charter schools. We've seen more accountability systems, more of a focus on testing, which is not something that everybody agrees with. We've seen in New York, we've seen smaller schools, new smaller schools. There are lots of changes that are coming about in New York, for example, that would not have been possible under the old system. We've seen more change in New York since 2002 than we've ever seen in the history of the school system, and that's significant.
Doesn't mayor control just really come down to the competency, the ability, the dedication of the actual mayor in question?
Absolutely, and at least as important, the superintendent or chancellor or CEO, whatever they call them in the particular place, who's actually responsible for running the schools. The mayor, in most cases, selects the school board, and the school board will select the superintendent. In some places, the mayor selects the superintendent or chancellor also. But the chief executive of the school system is really a key person. And the success is going to depend on the ability of that individual to have a vision for the schools and to implement it effectively.
Now, what happens if a mayor gets voted out of office? Does the next mayor still in charge of the school, or does that have to be voted upon?
No, the way most of the laws continue beyond the tenure of a particular mayor. In New York City right now, the law sunsets in June. So the legislature is considering what to do. They will either let the law expire, which is improbable, or they will implement it, renew it the way it is, or make changes in it.
What inspired you to actually write a book where mayors take charge? Who's supposed to read this book? Who's your audience?
I think it's certainly anybody who's interested in the future of urban schools. It's a phenomenon that's taking hold in lots of places. It's under considerations in diverse places like Rochester, New York, and Milwaukee, and Memphis, and about a half a dozen cities around the country right now, Jersey City, Newark. So it's something that people are considering. It's an important issue, and people need to go in with their eyes open. It's something that can improve the capacity of schools to get better, but it should not be seen as an immediate fix. There are no magic bullets in education, as I said before. So you have to go into it, and the system has to be crafted in such a way that it allows for executive leadership, but also allows for participation by the public.
Professor Joseph Vitteretti, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning. Professor Vitteretti from Hunter College in New York. He's the editor of When Mayors Take Charge. Todd.
So we've also got the financial crisis on our minds, unfortunately. We're all a little stressed out, and so we're looking for ways to cope. How do you help someone going through tough times? Lend some cash, or an ear, or just advice? And if you've suffered from the recession blues, what advice do you have that you've received that's really, really helped? Well, go to our website, thetakeaway.org, and tell us. And while you're there, you can subscribe to our podcast so you can catch up on anything you missed. That's thetakeaway.org. And this is your takeaway.
Having no government, being a failed state means what? I mean, these young men, one of them told my friend in Mombasa, he says, look, I've never been to school. I can't read or write. I have no prospects at all. All I have is my courage and this, waving his Kalashnikov.
That's Nick Rankin, author and broadcaster, giving us context on the Somali pirates. And
do you know what my takeaway was? It was Nick saying goodbye in his pirate voice. I love that.
You do. You set him up for it, too.
Meanwhile, what's happening tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow on The Takeaway, we're talking to Stephen Bright, president of the Southern Center for Human Rights, about states across the country that are putting people in debtor's prison for not being able to pay their court fees. They're bringing debtor's prisons back, Femi.
And you can listen to that conversation tomorrow on our show or on our website. I'm Femi OK.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James O. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Hi, Lisa. Hi, Super Nintendo Chalmers.